Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week, I first met back in the mid-90s when she was working as a publicist for acts like Take That and Robson and Jerome. Then in 1996, she turned up at the Smash Hits offices, where I was the editor at the time, without an appointment and with a new band in tow who, frankly, stormed the office, danced on our desk, took over the office hi-fi, yes, that's what we called it, and delivered a masterclass in girl power. They were, of course, the Spice Girls, a band she helped to break and eventually manage. Then came an unlikely job offer as a judge on a new Saturday night TV show, Pop Stars, and the talent show went on to create Hearsay and made her a household name too. The band and the show were a huge success, all of which meant she was the obvious candidate to play the same role again, only this time on Pop Idol, alongside Pete Waterman, Neil Fox, and a then unknown Simon Cowell. It's 20 years since Pop Idol first aired. And since then, she's left behind, working behind the scenes to step in front of the camera full time, hosting Escape to the Country, The Chelsea Flower Show, Wanted Down Under, and is a regular voice on Radio 2. Married to Dave Shack, who she met when they worked at the same record label over 20 years ago. She lives in London, and I'm so thrilled she's on the show. Let's dial her up. It's Nikki Chapman. How are you?
I'm really well, thank you, Kate. How are you?
I'm good. I mean, you and I have been speaking a little bit recently because we've been making anniversary shows because we're at that stage of our career now, Nick. Looking back on Pop Idol. And it's been so nice to be in touch again and relive some of those magical memories, weren't they?
Oh, amazing. I mean, in a way, our careers sort of run side by side. You know, you were the youngest editor of a magazine that we needed in the music industry, you know, a renowned journalist. I was a publicist or a plugger in those days, as we were called. And so we've known each other, well, over 20 years now. But I think Pop Idol was the ultimate, wasn't it? It brought us together. And
absolutely.
It's difficult to believe. Some part of me thinks it was like yesteryear, and then another part thinks, I don't think it ever happened. It's weird. But such fond memories and life changing for me. It really was.
I mean, for so many of us, because, you know, I got the call to come and do the show, then went on to do X Factor. It put my career in a completely different space and place. And catching up with Will, I know you're still in touch with Will, who's doing so well 20 years on. It's quite remarkable, isn't it?
Brilliantly, doing really well, seems really happy, which has to go hand in hand with success. It's no point having success if you're not happy. And Gareth the same. And you can't say that about a lot of the shows that are around. I think we were genuinely looking for that Pop Idol, somebody super exciting, so talented, that was going to explode onto the scene. Whereas a lot of the shows now, and they are brilliant, but they're TV shows first. Whereas the priority at the beginning was to find the idol. Yeah.
Well, I can remember, you know, we'd sit around talking behind the scenes and it was like, this is a lot of money. We're giving this winner a record contract and it's going to be worth about £1 million in terms of marketing. And so, you know, that was the driver for it all. Not, you know, I mean, obviously everybody from ITV wanted to make a great TV show, but you were there with your star searching hat on because ultimately you would be working with the winner because you were partnering up. But by that point, you'd gone to work with Simon Fuller, who you'd met whilst you were plugging. Who did you plug for him? Annie Lennox.
It was Annie Lennox, Kathy Dennis, and then the Spice Girls. Yeah. And it was actually after being with Annie, we'd had dinner that we were discussing what the music industry needed. And I said, go off and find a girl group. And he rang me about 7 weeks later and said, I found them. And I was like, who? The girl group you told me to go and find. I'm like, oh, God, yeah. And that's the difference. He went off and did it and I didn't. But I had a really lovely relationship with Simon. And so, you know, I was delighted to be part and, you know, day to day managed his acts for him. So it was a big part of my life. And, you know, to have Will and Gareth just be such delightful people, but again, super talented at the same time to work with and very different. That was what's so brilliant about that final. I mean, we're going back to that day and anybody of an age will tell you where they were the day or the week of the Pop Idol final. I can remember sitting in this meeting at 19 and there was Nigel and there was Simon Cowell and we were coming up, you know, with the idea of the battle buses and everything else. And it was an extraordinary time and an extraordinary piece of television in actual fact. And then you look around the world and there's so many very similar shows that have come off the back of it. And rightly so, you know, it isn't just about one show. It's about time and moment and people's passion for the music industry.
Yeah. Well, it's not just shows that are similar. I mean, Idol itself has lived in multiple territories. I mean, you've got Cambodian Idol, for goodness sake. You've got American Idol. I mean, great careers have been broken out of it. And, you know, I mean, obviously lots of people have come and gone through those doors and it never moved the dial for them. But then there are those like Adam Lambert, Carrie Underwood, Kelly Clarkson, Jennifer Hudson. I mean, hello.
Who didn't win.
That's quite significant.
Back on it, it's an opportunity because, you know, the way we look at finding new talent, I mean, it's changed in the last 10 years, it's changed beyond. But take us back 20, 22 years ago. How do you get yourself in front of an A&R man? How do you find a manager? How do you go about breaking into the music industry as a solo artist? Perhaps with bands, I'm not going to say it's easier, but there's different avenues, isn't there, to explore. But if you're a solo artist, you've got to bank on someone discovering you. And Idol and all those shows were the opportunity.
And it was interesting because another of your former clients was a recent guest, Gary Barlow, on this show. And he was talking to me about, I mean, like he used to do the, you know, the well-trodden ground of get the train down to London. His mum used to give him a packed lunch to bring down with him. And then he'd treat himself to a Mackey D's on the way home. And he'd go and sit in the reception of the major record labels with his cassettes, waiting for somebody from A&R to come by. That's how he would do it. And then, you know, that was kind of 10 years previous to where we got to with Idol. And just his tenacity got him through.
But he really did earn it. You know, he was out there grafting and he learned his trade. So by the time he was picked up by Nigel Martin-Smith, who was putting together a boy band, Nigel saw in Gary not only this fantastic singer, but equally a brilliant writer. And I think he was like 16 or 17 years of age. Not everybody has those skills and that experience at such a young age because he was doing it from like 12, 13, 14.
If you don't mind, I'd like to set the scene about how significant a player you were in the music industry and how unusual you were actually when we both started out. So, I mean, it was a real boys club, the music industry. There weren't many women sitting at the top. And you were a publicist, a plugger. So a plugger is somebody that gets your stuff on the TV and the radio predominantly. And you were really successful. And then you left the comfort of a label job where you worked predominantly, you know, on big, big acts for managers like Simon Fuller or A&R guys like Simon Cowell. And you set up on your own and you became kind of like, it was called Brilliant PR, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. What a modest title to have, Brilliant PR.
No, but there was you and Nick Godwin, and Nick famously discovered Amy Winehouse. I remember having discussions with Nick about this young girl from the Brit School that he'd found, and you've got to hear her. She's exceptional, and she was.
And so Nick and I were thinking of leaving RCA. They offered me Nick's job, and Nick was my boss at RCA, and what they didn't quite appreciate was he was also my best friend. So I went to see Nick and I said, look, I think it's time for us to leave. They're just taking Kylie Minogue off me because she'd gone to work with somebody else and another act. And they hadn't told me. They just made the decisions. And then I found out through somebody else. And I suddenly realized how vulnerable I was at a record company. Not vulnerable personally, but in my career. Like, you're in the hands of somebody else. And I loved my time at RCA. It was a great group of people. But the penny dropped and I went to see Nick and I said, we need to leave. And he's like, no, I'm loving it here. And I went, no, you and I, we need to leave. We're good together. We've got to set up our own company. It's time. And he's like, no, I really don't think so. I was like, Nick, you've just offered me your job. And that's brutal. And that was the music industry. Every single person that I worked with was let go over the years at some point or other. Mm. Now, the good news is they normally bounce back and went for a better job somewhere else. But, you know, as you know, Kate, a record company is made up of many parts. Certainly in the 80s and 90s, it's like a jigsaw. And every part of the jigsaw is important. But if promotions, and I'm talking TV and radio, if they don't get the act away, then the act doesn't
happen.
Exactly, because everything else...
Yeah. No radio, no go.
Exactly. Yeah. Radio or TV. And Spice Girls, no radio, but luckily TV got it away. So we set up, and Gary Barlow actually said, if you leave, I will fund you, which I've never said before, actually, which is really, really kind. And he said, I'll back you guys if you leave. And then we met Neil, and Neil said, well, look, I've got a company. It's called Brilliant. Why don't you come over and join us? So we did. Nick and I went over there, and it was very, very successful. We had such a huge roster of artists. And then in the end, Matthew and me and Billy. And it was just the two of us. And that's when we decided, okay, we're going to get into management. We got Amy Winehouse. We managed Billy Piper. And they were brilliant days, but it was a stepping stone into what was to come.
It really was. So this is kind of mid-90s. You are quite unusual to be that high ranking as a woman in the music industry at that time. I mean, I would say certainly you were outnumbered, as was I. So I sat in a different part of the business, but I was in charge of arguably one of the most important music magazines, certainly in terms of breaking new acts.
Definitely.
Which brings me very nicely onto my first question for you. Are you ready? 1996. Do you remember bringing the Spice Girls in to see me at Smash Hits? Because I thought that was quite a high risk move. You didn't have an appointment as far as I knew. I was in a meeting with my publishers, and then out in the office, I heard this just chaos unfolding around me. And Helen, my PA, put her head around and she went, you better come out and see this. And we all had to just leave our desks and leave this meeting and come out. And we were, I mean, it was a shock and awe exercise in girl power. And there was no way you or the Spice Girls were leaving until we committed to support you and cover the act. And I wanted to know from you a little bit more about the strategy behind that, but also when in your own life, such a high risk move and a sort of nothing to lose moment has really paid off for you.
It's how I actually first saw the Spice Girls. They came into RCA Records on rollerblades, got on the desk. They did everything that we hear about, and it is absolutely true. And I was like you, my mouth just hit the floor. And the girls were such a power, and they had such belief, and they were united. This is what they wanted to do, and thoroughly convincing. And then they get out the Ghetto Blaster, and they put it on the side, and they start singing, you know, along in a cappella, and then to a bit of a backing track. And I was so blown away. And I sort of said to them and to the manager, you know, this is great, but I'm not going to be here because I'm leaving RCA Records. I'm going to go independently. And that's when they said, right, well, we want to be with Nicki. So one of the first acts I took with me was Take That and the Spice Girls and Annie Lennox when I went independent. So they really did help set up my business and the success that we had.
Wow.
So when you take that element, and no one was doing that at the time,
you would just come in and just take over, wouldn't you? But it's quite risky. It could have backfired. You could have pissed somebody off with it by not sort of giving them, you know, we were in the middle of quite an important meeting.
We did.
Oh, you did.
We did manage to annoy someone. We did EMAP. We did the big breakfast. I can't really repeat what the girls said in today's world to the boys, because it was really fruity. They took no prisoners at all. And then I took them into Radio 1 to see a lovely lady called Susie Aplin. And Susie was looking after TFI at the time. And I took the girls in, and Chris, who we all know, we love Chris Evans, you know, one of the best presenters, broadcasters you're ever going to meet, was in a really bad mood. And he walked past and he said, "Why don't you lot F off back to Live and Kicking where you belong?" And I was like that. And we were in this glass office with this ghetto blaster, and the girls giving it all loads as they did. And Jerry literally made a beeline for the door. And I was like, no, not today. No, let's just hang on. He's not in a good mood. I think he'd just been reprimanded by Radio 1. And we just, the timing was awful. But funnily enough, yeah, after that, it was a success, but it took a long time to convince Chris. That's the truth. The first TV show I put them on was Surprise, Surprise. A lovely lady called Isabel Hatton, and she was the producer. And we dragged her into the toilets, into the ladies' loos, and they did their number for her in the loos. And when I say with their number, I'm obviously talking singing and nothing else. Thanks very much. Before anyone checks.
Bit of wannabe, yeah.
Yeah. And she put them on Surprise, Surprise, which was the biggest TV show around at the time. So we did a couple of TV shows, but that was the one that sort of set us up. And radio was really, really slow, and we didn't ever do TFI, not until much, much further, you know, later, further down the line. And Chris was at Radio 1, and he didn't play them. He wouldn't play them, and he had the breakfast show. So it took a lot longer to convince him. But then once he was on board, I think he went out with one, and he really has supported them since then. So, but it doesn't, you know, you look back and it wasn't all, you know, just steamrolling ahead. There were a few battles to be had because people were a bit like, who are these girls? It's a bit annoying. Are they manufactured? And there wasn't, although there was a lot of hype around Spice Girls, it didn't feel overly manufactured because they were such a dominant force. And they took control of every conversation. I went to Japan with them. We hadn't even charted. And we took out Loaded with us. Funnily enough, they were one of the first mags to sort of think, oh, actually. And they tried to take them on, and it was hilarious because the journalists in the end were like, I surrender. You know, they loved the girls, but the girls weren't giving them an inch. And that's what they did because they truly believed in what they stood for. It wasn't a man or a woman behind them going, hey, I've got this great idea. Let's talk about girl power. It came from them. It was transparent. It was authentic, and they believed it. And here we are 20 years down the line and just having celebrate 20 years of Wannabe. And it's more resonant today than it's ever been.
I mean, when you came in with them, I remember you sort of just sort of hanging in the door of the office, the main entrance of the office, and these girls were just doing their thing. By the time I came out, Jerry completely and utterly just bamboozled me. You're the first female editor of Smash Hits. We are all about girl power. I'm like, what the hell is girl power? She's like, you have got to support us. It's your duty as a woman. And it's like, that's probably quite a fair point, actually. And they were a very hard sell for me with the guys upstairs because they supported my decision to give the girls a cover, but there was a lot of like, ooh, because girls didn't sell magazines to girls. They changed that. And we had to take a chance with them. They were a different league, the Spice Girls. And my boss was going, but, you know, Shampoo, we wouldn't put them on the cover. I was like, trust me, these girls are special. They're different.
That's amazing.
But I think for all of us, we all took a risk, right? But what about in your own life, Nick? When have you taken some big risks?
I think probably the first risk I took professionally would be jumping ship from RCA Records. I had a great job. I looked after Take That, Kylie, you know, Eurythmics, Annie Lennox, loads of different artists. And, you know, if you want to look at the basics, I had a good salary. I had a company car. They had plans for me. But I wanted more. I wanted to be in charge of my own career. I didn't want to be dictated to. And also I wanted a hand in what artists that I was going to work. So that if I didn't want to work an artist, for example, Simon Cowell offered me 5, I'd already left RCA by then and I turned them down. They weren't what I wanted to work at the time. Brilliant band, loved the music, but I wasn't going to work it. And I wanted to have that so that when I went over from RCA to Brilliant, I could work David Bowie. You know, I was able to work with Phil Collins, Spices, of all these artists that were on different record labels. I wasn't confined to one. So that probably was the first risk that I took. And then the second risk would be when I left Brilliant, Nick and I had been running it for 5-6 years, and I went over to work with Simon Fuller as his creative director at 19. It didn't seem like a risk at the time, but because I was so excited going into this new venture. but I was stepping away from a very successful business that I'd built up just to try something different. I wanted to work in television. I didn't want to be in front of the camera, but I wanted to work more in TV. And I wanted, at the time, funnily enough, we had Amy, to do more management. So, I mean, really exciting times. And also, every year is great in the music industry. If you're working in it now, how brilliant is that? But when we were involved, there was money on the table. You could be creative. And as a publicist, you know, doing marketing, being out there with your band, that's what you wanted to do. We were able to film behind the scenes, travel around the world, as well as having the fantastic parties and all the rest that you hear about. Yep, it happened. And it was great times. And we didn't feel the pressure that there is in today's world, not just in the music industry, but in all areas of media. It was a laugh. We all worked so bloody hard, but we had a great time doing it.
And also, you're right, there was so much money in the business then. I remember being flown, I'm not joking about this, this is true. I was flown to Los Angeles. I only had a day that I could do this to interview the cause, right, for Marie Claire magazine, I think it was. By then I was a contributing editor for them. But they were on a video shoot in the desert and the label flew me out first class. Right? I literally stayed 4 or 5 hours and flew straight back. I had a driver meet me at the airport to drive me into the desert where he waited and then drove me back to LAX to get me back to London because I had another job the next day or whatever. And they just threw money at it, just to throw.
I can remember taking somebody to New York to go to a gig. And my husband, well, it wasn't my husband at the time, he was living out there. So we went to see him. And it was like, we had the best weekend. We saw a gig for like 2 hours and came home. Business class first. Not first, by the way. Sadly, I didn't go first. But, you know, it was great. Absolutely brilliant. I mean, probably not the best way to run a business, but I wasn't complaining.
See, well, listen, thank you so much for sharing some of those risky moments, because I know you so well, Nick, and I often wonder, do the Radio 2 audience know how seminal you were as a mover and a change maker in the music industry? And I don't know that they do, and you were. You were hugely significant. You broke acts. You managed their careers with huge success and you never really shouted about it. So I'll shout for you.
Oh, well, that's really kind. I loved it. But my job is really weird, was always behind the scenes. And I still think to this day I'm a better coach than I am a player, is the honest truth. But I love being behind the scenes. I mean, not so much when, you know, you spent 2 months of your life setting up a David Bowie interview and everyone's all over you like a rash. And then the moment the day comes and they literally put their hands in front of your face and push you out the way to go and say hello to him and you're left at the back, forgotten. But that was my role. Mm. You know, my role was to enhance people's careers, to illustrate their careers, to keep that fame, if you like, if you want to make it in the crudest possible sense, if you're famous, you came to work with me to continue that level of fame. You know, if you're promoting an album or a single. And then I did sort of get the name for breaking new artists, like Charlotte Church and some of the ones that we've mentioned today. But yeah, I was paid to be behind the scenes. And actually, in a way, I quite like that.
You know, you were utterly brilliant. And, you know, when you brought a new act to me, I took you seriously because you had form. You had broken incredible new artists and then managed their trajectories. You know, take that. Look at what you did with them. Look at what you did with the Spices. You know, just on a pure pop play, they were the two bands that are pop music of the 90s, like that pure pop. And you had a hand on both their shoulders. So congratulations. Very well played, my friend.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Changed, which takes me on nicely to question number two. Your career is one of like phenomenal change and unprecedented success. So whenever you decide to change lanes, and you do it really, really well. So I wanted to know who were the change makers along the way that you had in your corner that enabled you to fly to the top of whatever profession you chose to pursue?
I'd love to say women. But just because of the people that I was working with, it was men, in actual fact. And right. I've always loved working with women. I actually moved record labels because the MD was a woman called Lisa, and I really wanted the opportunity to work with her. In TV, there are more women that I work with than men, but certainly in the music industry, you've hit the nail on the head, it was all about male domination. But I worked with incredible men that were extremely kind and motivating and were there. So the first one would be Nick Godwin. He was my boss at RCA. I can remember the first meeting I had with him, and we agreed the terms, and I was going over and the salary, the car, whatever. And then he said to me, is there anything else you'd like? And I said, yeah, can I never have lunch or dinner with this TV producer? And Nick went, yep, okay, I get that. I'll always shadow you. I'll always be by your side. I mean, how horrendous that a job interview, you have to say that, but he got it. And I never felt vulnerable.
And this is because this person you're talking about is a bit, well, overly familiar.
Yes.
Abusive of their position.
Yes.
Sexually inappropriate.
Yes. Yeah. And there were the days of the late 80s and early 90s, sadly. Not everybody, I might add, but there was a few and they were in really high positions, power. And, you know, you've got to remember that if I'm going in every day trying to plug my acts on their shows, I'm vulnerable. And Nick was just one of those people that, it's not just about that. That's just one instance that I haven't really shared before, but he was I'm still best friends with him, the nicest man, the nicest, kindest person.
Yeah, good guy.
A good guy through and through. And then we became partners and to this day we're still friends. So he would be somebody that helped me make that jump. The other person would be Simon Fuller. Again, an incredibly unassuming, kind soul who got me. And the one thing about working with Simon, I went over as creative director, he was this genius, this impresario, but he hated anybody really meeting him and knowing him. He didn't want to be in the papers. He didn't want any fame whatsoever. He wanted success for his artists. And what he would do is, we'd like, say, for example, the Spice Girls, he and I would sit and plot. We'd plot for hours and hours and hours, and he wasn't going to release the music until he was ready. But he would wind me up like a spinning top and send me on my way. I was his muse, if you like, and I'd be off and I'd go. And I love that. I love being number two. I don't need to be number one. I've never been number one in my career. I've had success, but I've always had amazing people around or above me, and I'm happy with that. Throughout my career, I've loved being second in command. Happy with that. And I don't want that to sound condescending, because it's not. I know my place. I don't have to be number one. You know, the Simon Cowells and Simon Fullers are quite rightly at the top of their tree. If life is a triangle, they're at the top, or a pyramid, they're at the top. I'm quite happy to work under them. And that's where I get motivated, working with incredibly talented, dynamic, sometimes quite forceful people, but going out there and doing it, working on a project. I don't need to be number one. I like being number two.
So we've got Simon Fuller, you've got Nick Godwin. Who else were your change makers? Because then came the transition from music to being on screen. Who were the the men or women that enabled that to happen for you?
I was doing an audience. It would have been an audience with Elton John. And I had the girls on there. And I've known Nigel Lithgow for a long time. Now, Nigel used to be a choreographer. He was a dancer, choreographer, and then going through the ranks, he became head of entertainment for LWT. Now, for those of you that know LWT, you'll be like, oh, my goodness, I remember all those shows. But for a lot of people, he made Saturday Night TV. He had...
That was it.
Oh, everything. You know, every major show, Barrymore, Cilla.
Surprise, surprise, Barrymore. Yeah. All, I mean, anything. Huge. All the Seaside specials. He just, he was the don of Saturday Night LA Light Entertainment. The shiny floor he shows.
He owned it and he had a brilliant relationship because LWT fed into ITV and he had a brilliant relationship with a lady called Claudia Rosencrantz. And Nigel's son had been in Australia, seen a format, loved it, said to his dad, you've got to come out here and buy it. And it was called Pop Stars. Developed by some, I think, two New Zealanders and then went out in Australia, huge hit. And he came back and he said to me and he said to Simon Cowell, why don't you come and be judges? We're going to put together a band. The judges will decide who's in the band. Public had nothing to do with it. We're going to film it warts and all, and it's going to be a TV program. Now, at the time, I was working 911 and I'd put together acts before. So I was like, yeah, that's fine. You know, I'm not really going to be on camera that much. It'll be great. Simon Cowell, who was dipping his toe into TV at the time and realized that TV was the perfect vehicle to break an act, there'll be A&R men that would snigger at the acts that Simon Cowell was finding and developing.
And Simon and they Cowell did. And they care. Did. He was.
Yeah, he was a joke.
He didn't give a toss, did he?
No, he made lots of money, had loads of success. So he was really up for it. But then he suddenly thought, oh, I don't know if I want to do this. So he pulled out at the last minute and a guy called Paul Adam actually stood in his shoes, who's A&R, I think, for one of the record labels. So we made this show. So Nigel certainly was somebody that had total faith in me, but I did it in all innocence. I didn't see the bigger picture. I didn't have a game plan. All I was doing was putting together a band that I'd done before and I was going to manage them. So he and Claudia decided that this was the way forward. And this little show that we filmed became this juggernaut. I went on, I was away with Simon Fuller. And I can remember calling home and Shaki saying it was going out every night, which was unusual. Claudia decided that it should go out every single night rather than once a week. And Shaki rang me and he said, oh, when you come back, Nikki, you might want to make a bit of an effort. The show's huge and people might, you know, recognize you. You might want to get out your tracksuit and put some makeup on. Because I'd left the UK for a trip overseas, having not seen the show. I didn't see it while I was away because we couldn't in those days view stuff while you were abroad. And I came back and everyone was talking about Pop Stars. So certainly Nigel and Claudia were huge, absolutely huge. Mm. And then I have to bring up Simon Cowell because he and I had worked together at RCA. He'd given me nearly all his acts. Then when I went independent, we carried on working together. And then he was very much part of Pop Idol and the judges. So when I look back on my career, I have to say I'm so grateful because it's not just the artists that gave me the reputation, but it's also all these wonderful characters that I worked with as well.
Yeah. And you did have a very good working relationship with Cal. And you took, I mean, he would play... he would play with you sometimes. So I remember what the show was, I must have been Idol, where you started saying something. We were on a break, and we were all sat around and he went, oh, not now, Nikki, the grown-ups are talking.
Yeah.
And you went, oh, Simon, fuck off.
Yeah. He used to say
and he didn't mean it, by the way. I'm not hanging him out to dry here. He was joking.
Well, we like to think so. He used to say to people, what have you come as today? You know, he just used to like crush. And it was mainly women, let's be honest. And most of the women would really give it back and he would love it. It was cat and mouse with him. It was cat and mouse. I was lucky because we had that reputation together, because we'd worked together and I knew him. It was done in jest, but you can imagine that for a lot of people, and I know there were people within the team that found him really intimidating. Absolutely. But he loves it. He puts it out there. He wants it back. If he's going to be rude, he wants it back in bucket loads.
Yeah. I mean, that's his, But that's just how he converses. I don't think he realises. I don't know that he thinks he's being knowingly provocative. That's just how he is.
People, I mean, obviously now we're used to it, but when he was, you know, at the height of his fame here and stateside, everybody used to say to me, "Now, I've got to ask you, what's Simon Cowell really like?" And I'd say, if you were having a dinner party, one, he'd be late, because he's always late for everything. But two,
always late.
Always late. He is the ultimate dinner party guest. You would love him. And that's the truth. But let's talk about his lateness. Even Anton Deck used to be sitting around for like 3 hours. And when we were judging, I can remember instances when you watch the show, there's no Simon. And it's not because he's ill. We just couldn't wait any longer. We had to start filming because he didn't need to turn up till midday. And that never changed.
Yeah. And then sometimes you just go and have a bath in the middle of a recording day. You're like,
he's not a morning person. He probably is now because he's got a lovely son and life has changed. But when I worked with him in the music industry, he was a night owl. He used to sort of come in at like midday and then he would work late and have dinners. That was his thing.
What I loved about that time, though, is that, I mean, there were some really smart people around coming up with really great ideas, and then they got actioned. I mean, maybe we just live in different times now, I don't know. But things that, you know, you could have an idea, put it out there, and it would happen, and then the next thing you know, you're off and running with it. It felt like a time of anything is possible.
Yeah. Claudia Rosencrantz was running ITV from the entertainment side, entertainment and factual. And when we went in and pitched Idol to her the first time, and I really don't believe this would happen today, we didn't even have it written down. You have this thing called the Bible, i.e. open up page one, or you go online and look at page one and it tells you what the show is, how you're going to make it, and week by week. There was nothing. It was a verbal pitch. And she looked up and she went, "I'll have it." And that was it. And then we decided, Simon Fuller and I decided not to go to the BBC because we put a BBC meeting in the afternoon. So Simon Jones, who worked for the production company and Simon Cowell, decided to keep that meeting with the BBC. And they walked in and there was a committee. And that was the difference. And when they went in and pitched it, everybody was chipping in. Well, this might work and this might work. Now, it could have worked on the BBC. There's no way to say we don't know because we never tried it. But Simon Fuller and I came out and just went, "Claudia." And I know Cowell felt exactly the same, even though he did pitch it over to the other side. We didn't. We felt compromised because she was like, "I get it. We'll work on the detail. I get it." And I don't know whether that still happens today.
Well, not in my experience, it doesn't. And Claudia Rosencrantz is quite an exception in terms of her contributions to television. She ran ITV Entertainment working a 4-day week so she could have Fridays off with her daughter. She also ran ITV2, I mean, literally in a lunch hour, which is where I came into play with the ITV2 Pop Idol Extra spin-off, which was the first spin-off show of its kind. But Claudia was so instinctive. She gave me my career in telly. I will be forever indebted to her. But ITV are still dining out on her commissions. I'm a Celebrity, Dancing on Ice, Saturday Night Takeaway, X Factor, which has only recently just gone. I mean, all of those were Claudia's commissions, and they've stood the test of time. She really knew her stuff.
She did.
Quite the talent. Quite the talent.
Great television, but she also knew what the public wants.
Mm.
And that's not easy to gauge. And that's not having a million different, questionnaires going out. Do you like this? Do you like that? She had that gut feel. And I think Fuller and Cowell, the two Simons, also had that. You know, rather than just testing it
out
on people, they just went for it. They just went for it. Mm. And
they were, very instinctive animals, all of them.
Yes, instinctive. Yeah. What a good word, yeah.
I could plunder the 90s forever in a day, but it's time for us to move on to your final question, Nick. Are you ready? Here we go. Not a lot of people will know this, but you are a qualified professional and personal coach. And alongside all of your broadcast work, you take clients, you help to empower them and coach them. I love that. I love that you managed to have this as not a side hustle, but so that you run in tandem with all the other stuff you do. You're full of surprises. So I wondered, what else would people be surprised to know about you?
I spent many years working with my artists. So if you had a band or a solo artist and they were appearing on TV, which is what I sort of specialised in, it wasn't just about that performance. It wasn't about, okay, this is the outfit, there's your makeup and hair, get on and do it. For me, it was always about the bigger picture, about their health, about their mental health, feeling confident with what they're doing. So I used to sit and do lots of, not media training, but coaching with them unofficially, just getting to the bottom of any anxiety, what they were worried about, areas that we should stay away, areas that we can look at and perhaps talk about quite comfortably. And then when I was taking a back seat from the music industry, I realized that people were still coming to me and saying, oh, have you got time for a coffee? I've been offered, say, redundancy, and I don't know whether to take it. I just want to chat through my options. So I decided to put it on a professional footing and go and do all my exams and get my insurance. And then that way I can go into companies or work with individuals, not necessarily media-based, but helping people reach their potential. And there's a real difference between coaching and mentoring, and they're both brilliant. And I do mentor as well. Mentors where you work with someone, you explain what they're doing, and you help them move up the ladder. But in a way, you're giving them sometimes the answers, and that's really good in a business capacity. You know, if you mentor young people coming through, and it really does pay dividends. But coaching isn't about telling somebody what to do, because you can tell someone what to do till you're blue in the face, and they'll happily take on your advice. And then when the shit hits the fan and they're going through really stressful times, that goes out the window. So what you do is you work with them so that they come up with the answers, but you get them to a place where they can see the wood for the trees. And often that will take sessions, but they have the answers. They just haven't found them yet. And it is mainly about listening and asking the right questions and not talking, which is a miracle for me to keep quiet, let's be honest. And I find it really helps, not just working with the people that I work with, and some are very famous that people will definitely know and some aren't, but also I found it's really helped me in my life when I'm filming, when I'm working with people on Escape to the Country and stuff, to listening to what they're not telling me, because everybody thinks they've got the answer. Do you think I should take this job? Oh yeah, you should take that job because you're really good. Or they never actually say, well, why do you think you should take the job? What are the pros and the cons? Everyone's got their best, you know, they think they know you well, but only you know you. And certainly in the last few years, when I've been through some quite difficult times, as so many have, mainly with my health, funnily enough, those coaching skills helped me when I hit a crossroads and I wasn't quite sure what the future was going to look like for me.
And that was very scary, Nick. You still have a brain tumour. It's not malignant. That's the good news. There's a little bit left in there and you keep an eye on it, right? But the time that you realised that it was diagnosed, that you realised something wasn't right, by that point, it had grown to the size of a small golf ball.
Yeah.
And obviously, the news is good now, right? It's not malignant. You've been successfully operated on and you live with it and you manage it. But there was a time when you didn't have any of those assurances and that must have been quite terrifying.
It was. I haven't actually shared this with anybody, but back in October, I was having my yearly scan with my fantastic consultant who he knows I adore him. I tell him regularly in front of my husband how much I adore him. And the NHS that looked after me and continued to look after me so well. And he rang me and I was standing in a field because now we do phone, you know, appointments, don't we? We don't do it face to face. So he rang me with my latest scans and I'm standing in a field and the Escape to the Country crew are moved away. I knew I was getting the call. So they moved away. They gave me some privacy and I'm looking at all these pigs. I'm just painting the picture, but that's what it was like. And an amazing consultant rang me and said, the tumor, Nikki, has gone. For the moment, it's disappeared. Yeah.
Nick!
So I haven't shared that with anybody apart from the Brain Tumor Charity. Thank you.
Oh,
I know I get a bit teary. I'm going to get a bit teary.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. And they don't know why. And obviously, I've still got to be monitored because these things have habits of changing. So, you know, but we take the good when we can. Always look for the win in every situation. So, Bert, for the moment, has gone, and in the nicest of ways, I hope the bastard never comes back.
Right. Oh, Nick, that is just glorious news. Oh, I bet you cried a happy tear or two, didn't you?
Oh my goodness, I was sobbing. And he's like, Nikki, Nikki? I'm like, no, I said, do we know why? He said, no, these things happen. They had to leave a slither of him in because of where it was. It was too dangerous to take out. And for whatever reason, at the moment, it's gone. There's no trace, just the scar tissue. And so the NHS will keep monitoring me, and I will happily go to every appointment that they ask me to go to. But yeah, life-changing, absolutely. I wouldn't want anyone to go through anything like that. And so many people sadly are and do. And I know I am fortunate. I'm fortunate. It was benign, but even to live with it wasn't great. But yeah.
Oh, I mean, it must have just reframed everything. Because in those moments, you're such a doer and you're so organized, and all of that goes, I mean, like all the infrastructure that you thrive living through and around, all of that goes right. Because it's just like, am I going to live? That's it. Yeah. In that moment, am I going to live? And if I am, how are we going to do that?
Yeah. What will I look like? Yeah. How will I be? I did my will the day before I went in for my operation, which, you know, for my husband, the first thing I said was, right, we've got to redo the will. And he was so brilliant throughout those, that's just one very, very small part, that he was so brilliant. I told very few people, because it is life-changing. And there'll be people listening to this podcast that will totally understand what I'm saying. And there'll be people listening to this that will try to understand. But thankfully, they haven't had to go through it. And I hope they don't, because it is, it is the biggest thing. It's amazing what you will accept in life. You do find strength that you didn't know you had. And at first we weren't sure. We knew it was big. They said, you've got a large tumour. They thought I'd had a stroke. You've got a large tumour. But in actual fact, I now hear from people and their tumours are much larger than mine. You know, they've gone through, you know, hell and back. But it's taking each day and not knowing whether you're going to live or not. And then when my amazing consultant said, you know, well, I think we can get rid of this, but there might be ramifications. You might lose your sight in one eye. You might, your speech might be compromised. I was like, but can I see in the other eye? And he's like, well, hopefully, yes. You know, they have to give you all scenarios. And I was like, okay, fine. If I lose the sight in one eye, so be it. You know, I can live with that. That's a small price to pay for life. And who would have thought? We came out and Chuck's like, are you sure you're okay? You seem quite high. And I went, Chuck, he's told me I'm going to live. Unless something goes wrong on that operating theatre, which we know can happen, I'm going to live. I'll take, you know, be partially sighted or whatever.
I'll take that.
I'll take that. After my operation, everything, and I've got my fingers crossed as we're having this conversation, everything went in my favour. In 6 weeks to the day I was filming, yeah.
You are so no-nonsense. I love that.
Well, I was expecting to be at home.
3 months recovery.
Yes.
Yeah, 3 months they told you, and you were back at work in 6 weeks, Nikki Chapman.
I did check with my consultant before anyone thinks I was being stupid. I did go to see him and said, I really want to go back to work. I thought I was going to be ill for 3 months, and he went, so did I. And I said, am I mad going back to filming? I said, they'll look after me. They'll look after me. And he's like, you know what? If I couldn't perform surgery for 6 weeks, he said, I'll be going mad. And I can see the same with you. So I did get signed off. The only thing I have is I struggle reading now. That's the only thing I have, which is a small price to pay for my health.
Right.
My concentration isn't as good as it was. I find it hard to read books, and I don't know why.
Really?
Yeah. But apart from that, I take each day. Oh. Yeah. I'm very grateful.
Nick, thank you so much for coming on. I love talking to you. And I really hope that people come away with a really different view of just how much you've done and how influential your career has been, not just in terms of the stuff that we see and hear you do now, but all that came before that. You're quite remarkable.
It's really kind. I think we could certainly say the same about you as well, Kate. People probably know 10% of what you've achieved. But it's lovely to reminisce and to talk. I hope when I touch on my health, it helps other people as well.
I am blown away by the fact that, I mean, if anybody was going to obliterate a brain tumour, it's you. Do you know what I mean? If there's anybody that it's not going to survive in, it will be yours, because you'll just be like, well, I'm taking care of that. Right, let's write a list.
Yes, as much as I could do it, positive thought, you know, the NHS are an incredible They were incredible, but I'm going to look for the win, and it's not going to define me. I will get on with my life, and it doesn't define me now. That's important for me. Everyone deals with everything in very different ways, but for me, it's not Nikki Chapman with a brain tumour. It's always about being me.
How lovely was that? A chance to stroll down memory lane with the phenomenal Nikki Chapman. Thank you so much, Nick. And if you'd like to hear more great conversations with some brilliant 90s artists, then look no further than our back catalogue. We've got brilliant episodes with Gary Barlow, who she worked with, Steps, Travis, Sean Ryder, Skin from Skunk and Nancy, Lisa Stansfield's in there, Danny Minogue, Delta Goodrum, All Saints, and Sophie Ellis-Bextor. I mean, it's practically enough to make my own top 40. My thanks, as always, to you for lending us your ears for the hour, and to Ben Robbins and the Yahoo Studios team who produces the show with me. As always, our editing is by Eleanor Humphreys, and our very own 90s superstar, Andy Bell, is responsible for the beats. I'll be back next Friday with more great guests. Until then, take care.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.